Our main speaker tonight is John M.
Good evening, everyone. My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here tonight for several reasons. One of the most immediate is a nice, large podium, so I won't have to hold my stomach in for 35 minutes. I like that. I like that in the name of the meeting. And the other is that I am sober tonight and get to come and hang out with my own time. I'd like to welcome the newcomers and thanks for the 2 minute speakers. I heard some things that I could identify with. And I think I sound a little bit like Brenda Vaccaro too. I'm not sure on that. And I probably wouldn't have the record in this room. I drank for about 25 years. I started later in life. I started at 17 years of age. My dad was a big guy, and he said we wouldn't be drinking around the house, and so I believed him. I was afraid of him, so I didn't drink. It was back in the 50s, and when dad told you something, you pretty much did it, unless you could get away with something else. But I remember I had my first alcoholic thought at about 5 years of age. My sister was born, and then I immediately started dreaming of the old days and how it used to be. And I thought, and that was before I took alcohol. And I was fixed with all kinds of things. I'm an equal opportunity scumbag. I can fix with just about anything. I had three sisters, none of whom contributed to my alcoholism, and my mom. And I found out early on that if things were kind of bad, and I stood up stalwartly, that I could get their love, and I liked that. It felt good. It was warm and cozy inside, sort of like alcohol did for me. I don't know, if you can remember your first drink. I remember my first drink. I was 17 years of age, and I got a job on radio. Don't be impressed. It was a small little station over in Ontario. Had about like 500 listeners or something like that. More pure listeners than in this room. And, but it was a big deal for me. And I was just 17 and I was in college. And, I was a big deal in my own head. And, but I was afraid. And it talks about in this blue book that the other speakers talked about. This book tells me that I will be driven by 100 forms of fear. And one of the forms of fear is that I would screw up. And so I'd gotten this job in radio. And I was afraid that I was going to not do it. I spent watch out for what you pray for. I spent the whole summer trying to kiss up to these guys, and they said, "Oh, you come in and do the guys are going on vacation and you'll do these." And I got what I wanted, and I was afraid. And my friend, a buddy of mine, his mom was gone, and she had a great liquor cabinet. His grandpa had invented the printing press or something like that, and they had all kinds of liquor. And they said, "Well, let's celebrate that you're going to be this big deal," And I said, "Yeah, that's good." And I took that alcohol, and I went down, and it felt so warm and so nice. I know I don't need to explain this to you guys, but what it did for me was it made me feel like I was 6'2", which is sad because I'm already 6'4", but it made me feel like I was somebody. And I said that night what I was to say for nights for the next 25 years. If one drink makes me feel this good, what do you say to it? And of course, I got drunk, and I was late for work, and they thought it was kind of funny. The kid came in, and he was hungover, and they kind of like me, this young, strapping boy. I played football and all that stuff, and they liked having me around. They liked hanging out with me because we went to bars. I liked to hang out with the older jocks, and we go to bars, and if anyone said anything, they'd send me over. You put a couple of beers in me, and I'll go beat anyone up, And if they saw some attractive women, they'd say, "Don, go bring those women over to the table." And I'd go over, and sometimes they'd come back. I can't remember what I said to them. I wish I could, but my life would be different today. I was in a blackout. But so that was it. So I was to associate drinking with having fun. I had no idea that I was or was going to become an alcoholic. But what I was doing was I was working a good treatment for alcoholism. I was using alcohol. And alcohol is good medicine for alcoholism. The problem is it has a lot of side effects, going to jail and marrying a lot of people and a lot of identification. I don't have the world record in this room, but I had 8 wives while I was, only 3 of them were mine. So, it wasn't, it was a, it was all right, you know. But I would, and I get to make amends from time to time. Occasionally I will run into one of those deals. And so Alcoholics Anonymous is an ongoing program, and that's why we have a nice step. And I've worked for a long time. I first got to Alcoholics, and I went to jail, and I, you know, the stories, you know, it's like, my story's like your story, just a different character playing the role, and I'm in the world playing the role God assigned, and he had me doing this thing. And, you know, you put a few beers in me, and you don't know what's going to happen. And that's the problem. And in chapter 3, it says, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that someday he will control and enjoy his drinking. And the problem with that is, it's kind of like Clark Kent and Superman. Control and enjoy are never found in the same room at the same time. And I think, if I'm controlling my drinking, I'm not enjoying it, you know? And if I'm enjoying my drinking, you guys are scared. So, you know, it's not going to happen. And yet that is a great obsession for every. Now, every would mean everyone that raised their hand, you know, including the newcomers and the old timers and all of that stuff. And there's so much information in this book that I wish I had earlier. And it was available to me earlier. This man that comes to this meeting some 32 years ago, I did a play with him. And I was always coming in hungover. And he got me off. And he was this really lame guy, you know, and, you know, giddy and smiling and all that kind of, may I help you and all that kind of. And he says, you know, if you ever want to stop drinking, I'd like to take you over to some people who don't drink. And I said, yeah, you know, in another lifetime that'll happen. And he just said, okay, fine, you know, and allowed me to continue on being miserable and ruining lives and so forth. And you know, it's like I had a lot of things that I had to do, and I can't change it. I can't go back and change it. I can't, you know, it's gone. But what I can do is I can make this day the best one that is possible for me to have. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous 1969. Didn't quite get sober in 69. I got sent by the court. And in those days, you only had to go to 5 meetings. And, you know, I, in fact, I'll just tell you why I got sent. It wasn't my fault, by the way, you know. And I came out on the mercy of the court. I had this machine gun. And this guy, his wife, I was seeing, wanted me to go to jail, so he told the alcohol, tobacco, and firearm. And you know, I'm too smart for this guy, and I'm hitting it down at the growth house. Problem is, I had already developed the disease of alcoholism, and I was always drinking. And when I drank, I was kind of vicious to her, and she threw me out of her house. And you know, and I said something to her, and she said, pick this weapon with you. And I went out, and I was all yelling and mad, and she doesn't understand me. And I went, now you guys look like a smart group, you know, it looks like you'd know what to do. You'd take the machine gun, you'd walk out to your car, open your trunk, throw the gun in your trunk, drive home. I had no car. Because I told you, I was an alcoholic. And I rarely had a car. All of those years, I rarely had a car. And if I did have a car, I had a woman's name on it. Starting with my mom, who signed for me, and then on would have some other woman. You know, she'd either sign for me or give me a car. And, you know, if you signed for me, it meant you were giving me a car. I meant to pay for it. I meant to. I really want to. In this book, it says we all have moral and philosophical convictions galore that we could not live up to them. And I really meant to pay those payments, and it just didn't happen. And it started to go on, and I knew what I needed. I needed that right woman on my own. I went to jail. I went to Camarillo State, the mental hospital. And even in mental, I was an abuser of women. My deal was, and everyone doesn't do this, this is my deal. This is what I did that helped me to get there. No one made me drink. I made myself drink. But this helped me to get here. Women would take care of me and care for me and give me stuff and things like, we're talking like when I was younger, you know. I thank God it didn't work for me anymore and I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. That's why God, I always wondered why God makes us grow old, and now I know. He makes us grow old so we can stay alive or something of that nature. I know what it means. I can't quite explain it to you, you know. It's like the whole is equal to the sum of its parts, you know. We know what it means, but I can't explain it. So, you know, it's like I'm dreaming of all these things that I need, and I thought, I need just this right woman. And I've been through the couple of marriages, and I had a child, and never could pay my child support. And one day I was selling real estate. I had gotten my real estate license while in Camarillo State Mental Institution. And believe me, they love this story in Arizona, I can tell you that. They love the California story. And I was in there, and on Berkeley Rehab, I got my license, and it's kind of scary that the largest purchase you'll ever make is handed by a man who got his license in a mental institution, but that's the way they do it here in California, and it's not my fault. And I got a job at a real estate office, and I had made one of those moral and philosophical convictions I had decided that I wasn't going to drink, because I had had a lot of trouble with alcohol. I was always going to jail. You know, I had gotten arrested for that, having that machine gun. What happened was I went up the street and the cops came, and I'm smarter than any policeman. I hid the weapon in a bush, and he came up to me and got up in my face and said, well, someone called the police and said, there's a man with a gun on the street. And I said, I know, officer, this is a scary neighborhood. I'm trying to get home. And he didn't think it was funny at all. And he looked right at me and he said, look, punk, if you don't tell us where that gun is, I'm going to arrest you for drunk. And I thought, man, that's going to make me look pretty bad tonight. And I thought it over and I started to play Let's Make a Deal with him. I said, officer, if I tell you where that gun is, will you arrest me? He said, no, Don, look, we want to get you off the street, protect you from here, protect this community, protect all these people on the street that are looking at you. And, we just got here, and I want to arrest you. And I thought it over with this masterful mind of mine, and I said, now, let me see. Should I take the misdemeanor, the drink, the $25 fine, or should I go to the felony behind this number two over here? Look good. And you know what I did? I don't have to tell you guys. That's why I love hanging out with you. I told them where it was, and they took it, like Oswald's gun holding it, and all the people around are applauding. They caught Dillinger, and the cop, the police didn't get a bad rap. This guy was really cool. He did not arrest me. He had his partner arrest me. So technically, he kept his word. I went to court. I rode in on the bus. My idea of a great day in jail was getting chained to my right wrist so I could sit on the aisle, so I could have leg room in the bus. That was what my life was about, Boy, I had a 50-50 chance, and I'd do all kinds of manipulating, and sometimes I'd manipulate it right, and the policeman would come in from the other side and hunt up from the other side, just screw everything up. And I'm in court, and the judge is reading through the deal, and how they have a little half that and put bad people going, and he reading through all this record, and I thought, this is a little bit much. And he's embarrassing me in front of my lawyer companions that I came in with, making me look bad. That's the thing I didn't want to happen. And he said, Mr. Maxwell, do you have a problem with alcohol? And he said it right in front of these guys. And I stood up and I said, no, Your Honor, just when I drink too much of it. And they laughed too. And I said, terrible. And he said, well, we're going to send you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to the five meetings. And I didn't like them. I didn't not like them. They were fine. They were older people, about my age now. And they were really lame. And I think Pat mentioned it. They were all smiling and hugging and, all this stuff. Hi, how are you? Good to see you. The old court card. Come on in, son. That kind of deal. And I said, boy, these guys are hits. I hope I never get like these guys, And I did say, they would get up to the podium or wherever they were sitting. They were sitting at little tables at that time, and they'd say just incredible things about themselves that people could use against them, And they said, don't tell people this kind of stuff. And I felt really bad for them, and I wanted to stay around and hip them up a little bit, but, I had, a few lives to ruin yet. I wasn't quite through with my deal. So I was back out, and it was 11 years. I had, I was selling real estate, and I was shooting up that drug self-pity, self-pity for me as a drug, if you don't think it is, how do you feel when you're feeling sorry for yourself, your shoulders get down, and a lump in your throat, your eyes tear up, and it's all warm, and someone comes and pats you on the back and gets chills, and that's what drugs did to me, and so it's hard for me to get that self-pity, and I'm sitting there, and a guy had brought me a little from the title insurance, a little thing to put pictures of your family in, a Lucite cube. And I set it up on my desk, and I was going to do it, but I had no pictures of my family, because I didn't know where my family was, and the pictures I had were of my sisters when they were 6 and 7, and now they had 6 and 7 year olds, and it just didn't look right, but I am one of God's major thinkers, and I was reading the Sunday paper. I was, by the way, hungover. I had been the night before, boiled as an owl, And I was not feeling too hot, and I was feeling sorry for myself. And I was 33 years old. My life was over. I'm wearing shoes that are 33 tonight. So at that time, it seemed like my life was over, and we think nothing's ever going to happen. And I was feeling terrible and down, and I was again saying, let's make a deal. I cut this picture out of a a magazine. And, you know, if you cut real carefully, you can cut the arm off where the girl's smoking the cigarette, and you can put it in that little tube, and it looks like, it's my life, you know, and you're looking good. Oh, I put that baby up there, you know? And hey, you know, so I'm there, I'm sorry. I think if someone comes in, they're going to say, well, sure, if she likes Don, let's buy a house from him. You know, it sounds like it'd be a good deal to me. And so I'm feeling just terrible, and I made what might have been construed as a prayer. And I don't know if this happened, it could have happened. I said, you know, God, if I had a girl like that, if I had a house south of the boulevard, and I wanted to be an actor, if I could just get on television one time, and if I had a new car, well, you know, I'd have my shopping list going by now, you know. And God, I don't know, he may have been, he walked by and he said, oh man, not this mess again. All right, don't do this a minute. You know, this guy is a loser. Let's go and give him a girl like the picture. Let's go ahead and ruin her life and give him the girl in the picture. And I went to work for this gal, and we indeed were married sometime later. And we got a house south of Boulevard. By now you know me well enough to know we used her money to do it. That's because I had no money. And I got a car, and I got my first job in television. I had three dogs, and I lived on the side of a hillside, and I loved this woman, and this woman loved me, and she looked great on my arm, and I could not stop drinking alcohol. I could not stop drinking alcohol, because probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism. And I was still out there trying to muscle it in, trying to make it happen, you know, trying to use the self-will to get it happening. And after about 5 years, we got divorced. She left. I used to say we broke up. She left. And I was there. I was, and I knew that I had really gone to the bottom this time, and I was going to have to do something different. So I decided to get a better girl this time. You know, one that would understand me a little more. And I met this girl, a lovely lady, a lady who, by the way, is sober. And I think this is she's in this room today. And I love this woman. First time I've ever said this in front of her. You know, I was over at her house while practicing my disease, and I was watching television. And there was a television show, and this guy was getting sober on the television show. And the captain had sent him to the AA meeting. And about three scenes later, he's in this AA meeting, and 11 years later, I recognize it as an AA meeting. And I get all lumpy in my throat, and I start, my eyes start to tear, and I'm there. And she said, what's wrong? I said, well, you're going to get sober, you know. And the thing is, he was going to get sober, and I was going to die from alcoholism. And the next day, I decided to jump right into action, and I called and said, and I called over at Radford, where I had been 11 years before. And I said I never thought of Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet I was able to call right back to the place I'd been 11 years ago. So maybe I had thought about it. I don't know. And the guy says, come on over, Don. We're having an inside. Come on down. You know, you'll be a little afraid. And I said, hold it. I'm not afraid of anything, pal. I'll be over there, you know. And he says, okay, come on over. So I was there, and I called my girlfriend and said, honey, I'm not going to drink anymore. And she said, no, that's great. You know, like Lois must have said to Bill 100 times. And I went to fix the sandwich because I wasn't going to drink for the rest of my life. And I opened the refrigerator, and there's these two huge, those tall cans of Foster's Ale in there. You know, and my mother raised me, right? And I figured there were guys on Skid Row in Australia that would die for those. So I went ahead and drank them, and I never made it to the meeting. And two or three months later, I was doing some kind of a cockamamie deal with getting women that wanted to be actresses, and we were saying that, you know, we'd do these scenes with you, and we'll send all the major casting people in town. No one bothered to ask, if you know all these people, how come you're doing this, you know? But they're, you know, from Iowa or somewhere, nothing against Iowa. There's a lot of smart people in Iowa. One of them sitting right here tonight. But they were from, what's the state just north of Iowa? Whatever that one is, that's the one. Geography is not my, and so, you know, I'm feeling terrible, and I decided to kill myself. And I went home, and my guest was in front of this big picture window, and it was dark, and I could see myself and see what I'd become, and I decided to kill myself. And even in death, I wanted to look good, and I wanted to show these women what they'd done and how they'd made me suffer. And in my mind, I envisioned myself in my Marine dress blues, you know, with a 40. I was never in the Marine Corps, all right? But how great I would have looked, you know, in the 45, the curl handle, and I had none of these. The police had taken all of my weapons when a member of your group had come in one night. I had a shotgun and was going to kill myself or something, and my wife called him, and he came in, and I told him he's either very brave or very stupid, but he took it, so I have no guns left. And so my instrument of death was a 6-inch Ginzu steak knife. Yeah. Well, that wasn't so funny a couple of months ago, but right now it's funny. And I decided that I was going to, you know, to look good. I was going to cut real low. So that, and you understand, this isn't my thinking. I'm not saying it's right. So that when I was in my casket and the women filed by for days, you know, and there weren't going to be any women coming. It's interesting to see how she did that down there, you know. There weren't going to be any women coming. There was no one going to be around, you know. And it would take them days to find me. And a buddy of mine came in, and they said, "Don, you've got to talk on the phone." And he gave me the phone, and he said, "Please talk to this lady, please." And I, you know, I'm a people pleaser, so yeah, I'll talk to her. And on the phone was the suicide lady, the anti-suicide lady, you know. Suicide lady would say, "Do it," you know. And she goes, "No, don't do this. This is not a good idea. You've been drinking. Calm down. It's going to be all right. You need to go to either East Valley Mental Health or Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'd already been to Camarillo and abused the women up there, founder of Bush Therapy at Camarillo State Mental Hospital. And somebody, I'm not too proud of it, you know, and someday I'm going to be able to apologize. I say this, and you can, and I understand it totally, and go, "God damn, you know, what this guy is, I'm not, you know, you hear the saying, I'm not a bad man getting good, I'm a sick man getting well. I'm a bad man getting good, all right? You understand? Okay? And so I'd already been up to Camarillo, and I thought, with this lightning mind of mine, and I said, "There are some pretty nice-looking ladies over at Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe I'll fire on over there, sober up a little bit, get me a wife, and off into the sunset." Forgetting that probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism. And I walked into Radford, noon, the night before, barreled as an owl, with a hangover from hell. And I don't know if you've ever been to one of these even sober. It was a book study. And the chapter was, "Two Wives." I really wanted to hear that, but at least it was Paul. So I thought, okay, you know, these guys are welcoming me. And we read it, and all these women are sniveling, you know, in my head. You know, and gee, you know, why are they, you know, it's just a part of being a man. Don't you understand this, ladies? You know, it's part of the deal. But I stayed. One of the ladies, I looked across the room, and one of the ladies looked at me, and that was always a signal to me. I'm a drunk. And she walked right over and she said,
"You're new, aren't you?"
So yeah, she said, "Well, I'll come back tonight." And I did. I came back tonight, and I went for about 15 days, and on that 15th day, they were getting up and they were talking about God has come into my life and I've had a spiritual experience and my children love me and the check was in the mail and I found a parking space out front and I love you and all of this. And I'm thinking, hey, you know what? I've been sober for 2 weeks and I have no wife, I have no television series, and I'm driving someone else's car. Right? And I decided to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a meeting across the hill where a man had marked for me. A man had taken the time to get me in the back of the room and mark the meetings that he thought were good ones. And I was at a movie, and I decided I was going to my last Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I said, "Well, I'm not gonna drink anymore because I kind of like drinking. I kind of like the way I feel not drinking. But I'm going to continue to do marijuana and cocaine because, well, you know, a guy like me that goes out with a busy day of doing nothing." Needs drugs to calm down with, you know. And I said, "But I don't want to drink because I get kind of nasty when I drink." And I always went. So I went to one last Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I didn't know then why I went. I know now why I went. For the same reason I drank and used drugs. Alcoholics Anonymous meeting made me feel better. And so I went to this meeting, and I walked in, and it was in Westwood, the 2+2 speaker meeting. And I looked around, and the people looked like you guys. You know, all these well-dressed women and men with clean fingernails and all of this stuff. And I felt terrible. What a surprise. I was 15 days sober. surprised I'd feel less than. And I decided I was going to split. And I was getting coffee, and I said, well, if I'm not coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll take these 6 cookies home. And, you know, and I turned to leave, and just a little about where that handrail is, there was a man leaning against the door, and he was looking right at me. And he knew I was in trouble. And my eyes met and walked right over. And newcomers, remember this, if you're in trouble, get your eyes up off the floor, you know, wherever you got them, so that we can see what is going on. And he walked and introduced himself, and I looked at this man, and this man was the actor on television who had 12-stepped the other man, and I said to myself, my God, this guy's an Alcoholics Anonymous. And he spoke that night, and he talked the talk that I finally heard. And I went back to Radford the next day, my 16th day, and for the first time in my life, I raised my hand and I said, my name is God, I'm an alcoholic. And in here it tells me that at the first I have to admit to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. And people started giving me numbers and everything. And sometime later I met my sponsor, Cliff, here, and he said, you know, we're going to read this book and I'm going to help you. And he said, and I finally, by this time I had no cars in, and he would come all the way from Burbank to pick me up in Sherman Oaks. And I thought, why would a guy do this? And I used to think he was doing it for me, and he told me he was doing it so he'd stay sober. And he's been sober some 28 years, so next year, you know. And he got me into that book, and he said, you know, things about service. He gave me a prayer early on. I told him, you know, I was bragging, sitting around telling him about all the women I've been with and everything. And he said, I'm going to give you a prayer. You know, if this is not a good thing for you, Dan, because it hasn't worked so far, when you wake up in the morning and say, dear God, please don't let me drink alcohol or propose to anyone. All right? It was a good prayer, and it worked, and we got in, and I liked this guy. This guy had a certain something, a certain je ne sais quoi that I liked, you know, and at the end of the meeting, he wasn't just the most beautiful girl. He was just some guy that needed help, you know, and he would always bring me over and introduce me, and he'd say, you know, Don's got 20 days, Don's got 60 days, whatever, and after a while, I started watching what he was doing, and he used to talk out of that book all the time, and I decided, well, if I'm going to stay, maybe I should start reading it. And I started reading it and getting going. And then he said I was going to have to work these steps. And at about 6 months, I started on my 4-step. And by the time I was 11 months over, I had not finished my 4-step. And a man came to me. He was 17 years of age. And he said, Don, would you sponsor me? And I said, well, I'd better go ask Cliff, you know. And I went over and asked Cliff. And Cliff said, well, I'll tell you what you can do, Don. You can tell him how not to drink for 11 months. But you can't tell him anything about the 4-step. Because you haven't done and finished yet. And so, because I wanted to be like Cliff and be like the rest of the guys, I got into the book and I started going, and I brought the kid over, you know, and I'm telling him about the 4-step. I'm doing my 4-step just a few days ahead of him. And he said, what about the 5th step? Don't worry about the 5th step. We'll do that next week. Remember? All right. Okay. Easy does it. Didn't you see that sign? Easy does it. Now slow down. And I got sober. Another guy came. And we started walking. And we started walking in sobriety. And I found that other component of Alcoholics Anonymous, one that is very, very dear to me, and I know it's dear to you guys, is that second deal. There's the program. That's over here. That's in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then there's the fellowship. And I've heard people say, you know, gee, you can't just get a meeting. That fellowship isn't going to make you stop drinking. Well, it says in here, that if you have a problem with alcohol, can we substitute it because we have a substitute that's better? And it's the fellowship you'll find in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you mix this with this, if I can't quite pick this up with the program, I get the fellowship to help me out. And it made me a very powerful man. It didn't give me, I'm still powerless over the life, on life terms, but it made me a stronger man. And I started adding these men. And I had this little teeny down in life when I started out in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had this terrible, terrible way of thinking. And each time I added a man into my life got bigger. And we're all survivors in here. We're all survivors. And that's right here. This is surviving. And I hung out with these guys for a while, and I got up here to get and die, you know. And now I live. I've done the steps in here. I try to continue to do them. I do the maintenance steps. I do written 10 steps. I'm a big believer in the written 10 steps. People sometimes say it's not in the big book that you have to write them. It isn't a big deal. It says we continue to take personal inventory and we look for selfishness, resentment, fear, and self-pity. And it says in dealing with resentment, we set them on paper. It says that in the big book. And it says we've listed our fears. the selfishness that talks about that and sexual problems. That really screwed me up, that page 69. You know, but I wanted to hang out with people that would put that on 69. You know, my father said, well, you have a problem with sex, go to page 69. And I said, all right, I'll go there. And I thought, and I don't know this for a fact, and don't quote me because I'm not an authority. It could be true, though. I think that they wrote more about alcoholism just so they could get sex on 69. I don't know if that's... Could be. I don't know. It's been a good road for me. You know, hanging with the guys. I was recently through the earthquake, and I lost my townhouse, and it moved. I used to be down at Terminal Oak, now I'm down at Encino. You know, it moved there. The whole house didn't move, and 31 men and women, a couple of them in this room tonight, came over to help me move my things out of a very dangerous building. And my normal neighbors, you know, that had their brother-in-law and their cousin over, schlepping furniture, seeing this army of alcoholics coming through. And they don't look at, oh, look at this, isn't this, you know, Redmond's kid is there saying, Dad, videotape, interesting title Uncle John has there, you know. And that's the way things go, you know. But I gotta get off this thing. Alcoholics Anonymous has been great to me. And I found a God of my understanding right in this deal, in this book. That's what the purpose of this book is, to get me in contact with a power greater than myself that can solve my problem. My problem is I'm a liar. You know, my problem is I'm a thief. Most all alcoholics are liars. There's a buddy of mine sitting here tonight. I was over at his office, a couple months ago, and I was talking with another man I sponsor. And he's going and going. I said, hey, hold on, Scott. Excuse me, I didn't say your name. I apologize. F. Redmond here. I said, hold on, stop, you're lying. And he said, hear me out, all right? So, I have all this stuff. I have these things going on. Now, here's what's happened to me in sobriety. I want to let you know that day after Christmas, I was 12 years sober. Not a world record for anyone in this room, but a world record for me. And I want to tell you the things that have happened in the last 12 years. And if you don't know me, you'll say, gee, Don, it's kind of like bragging. I'm not bragging because I'm not telling you that stuff when I was working the Don program, you know, one drunk talking to himself. You know, I looked on the literature table earlier and I did not see my book as Don sees it over there. But this is very thin volume. Here's what happened. I got with these guys, I started hanging out with these guys and gals. I started doing what was in here. I got my own God, a God of my understanding. And I continue on a daily basis to try and keep it clean so I can stay out of insanity. And here's the things that have happened, and they never happened to me. I used to sit around, we used to have the LA Marathon. I didn't run the LA Marathon, but I used to always dream about running a marathon. And I never did it. It was always on a bus, so I'm gonna do that one of these days. And I always dreamed of getting in an airplane and going and skydiving. I always wanted to do that. And I always wanted to go to Europe. And I wanted to do something really nice for my kid when she graduated from high school. And all these things, I wanted to go fishing in Alaska. And what happened to me in sobriety is, I went to New York in 1988, and I ran and completed the New York Marathon, which is a pretty cool thing. And not only did I complete it, but the guy that won finished in 2 hours, 10 minutes. I stayed out there for another 3 hours. You know, so I'm a man. You know? I went to Europe. And not exactly a marathoner's body, you know. And I went to Europe and I 60 seconds. And I went to Europe and I treated a woman like a lady. She invited me back and took me to Milan and Florence. And I got for my daughter's graduation, she got to go to Hawaii. And then she wanted to see Phantom of the Opera. I took her to New York to see it. And I jumped there last year in February. I jumped out of an airplane in Hawaii. I had a parachute on it, you know. And a parachute, newcomers, is like this big book. It won't save your ass unless you open it up. And if you want to know, if you want to know what all of that stuff that I said, do it, scrape your parachute open, Don. What does that have to do with sobriety? What does that have to do with being sober? I'm going to tell you. Absolutely nothing. Unless you're the man or woman that dreamed of doing it, got sober, worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and did it. And we watch it all the time, and maybe your marathon is getting that first checking account. or a driver's license, or have an insurance, whatever it is. I had a great time. I'm really happy that I got to come out and hang with you guys. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad that I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's Wednesday night. I'm in today. Let the dreams begin. Thank you.